Spirits in the night. That is what we're talking about. It's Halloween. All right. So I'm trying to do the math on this. Pardon me. I know I'm getting it wrong. Everywhere now except Alaska and Hawaii, we're in the 48-hour countdown until election night. So, well into it. On the East Coast and the Midwest, just coming online to it on the West Coast, but Alaska, Hawaii, American Samoa, I guess, are still not quite in that 48-hour countdown to election night. And that is going to be amazing. It is going to be a big day coming up. And no matter what happens, George Norrie will be talking about the results or the lack thereof. On election night, and we hope you tune in for it. I know that there are many people on this Halloween night that are still in the spirit. They may be coming back, perhaps having been overserved with the spirit. And they may be wondering a little bit whether or not this next story is the kind of thing that's going to give them nightmares. And I would say absolutely yes. Richard Estep, a nightmare in Villisca, investigating the haunted axe murder house. You have got to hear this story next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So, I don't like to compare guests because you're all like my children. However, if I had to say which one was my favorite bio for the night, it would have to be yours, Richard Estep. I loved your About Me page on your website, richardestep.net. Do you mind if I share a little bit of that?
Be my guest, Ian, as I am yours.
Okay. So I just thought this was so funny because usually, there's a lot of bravado amongst paranormal investigators. There's a lot of chest thumping, and, I find ghosts 9.5% faster than the other people or whatever. And I just liked how you were. You had a level of humility to this that I thought was really beautiful. And you said, in the tiny amount of free time that does not involve paranormal investigation and writing about it, I'm an unabashed geek with a particular bias towards all things Star Wars. I have a Lego problem that may eventually require professional counseling if it gets any further out of hand. Perhaps above all else, I am a collector and reader of books, and I am a reader of yours. But there of the many fun lines in your bio, that was perhaps my favorite. I share many of those same hobbies. So thank you for coming on the air with us tonight,
Oh,
Richard.
it's my pleasure. And on Halloween night, that's a real honor to be on the show
It's
on
a
Halloween
perfect
night.
book. Perfect book. And people can tell from his accent that Richard Estep is not originally from the greater Colorado metropolitan area. Where did you grow up in England?
I grew up in Leicestershire, England. It's a fairly big city, but if most Americans have heard of it, it's probably because you guys heard about the king that was buried under the parking lot that was found a
Yes.
few hundred years afterwards.
King Richard, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And
Yeah.
he'd been missing for quite a while. Everywhere in Leicestershire, there's a King Richard's Road, King Richard's Schools, you name it.
Right.
We named it after King Richard. And we knew vaguely that he was buried somewhere. Nobody really suspected he might be buried under an office parking lot.
Well, and I hope it would only be appropriate if that's Richard the Third. He was the humpback, so he had a walking difficulty. I hope that was at least buried under the handicap parking spaces on the parking lot.
Oh, too soon, Ian, too soon.
No, too soon for a Richard the Third joke, really?
Absolutely. I'd just be happy if he finally pays his back rent and taxes, because I think he can do a lot with that.
Well, he might be. He, as I hear the stories that the Queen is going to hand over her crown, to William coming up, and she's going to take her retirement. So there could be more royalty news coming up this year, is what I'm hearing. But listen, thank you so much for giving us time because I love this story, and your investigations, the things you write about are. Like this story, obviously distinctly American. So you've obviously been here for a while. What got you started in the investigation of the famous haunted axe murder house in Villisca, Iowa?
Well, I'm kind of fortunate in that I get to spend my time at least not right now, but, you know, before 2020, I've got to spend my time split between both sides of the Atlantic. So I get to go back to the UK and investigate historic haunted places, and I get to do the same here in the US. And the truth is that when I'm writing about a location in Britain, it's probably some old Gothic historic location. And here in the US, it's somewhere a little more, and I hate to use this word, but colorful.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is, you know, a relatively new location that has a story attached to it that intrigued me and I wanted to learn more about and share with readers. And the Villisca Axe murders are kind of the quintessential poster child for that.
Yeah. Well, nothing wrong with investigating the death of Nearly Headless Nick or something like that, but I do think you're going to find a lot more recent evidence to work with from a murder that happened in 1912. Although that murder, as I was reading your description of it, it had a very contemporary tragic vibe to it. Take everybody through the original murder narrative of 1912.
Absolutely. So the biggest story in the American press back then for weeks, if not months, was the sinking of the Titanic. And the Villisca Axe murders are what finally knocked that off the front page. And we can talk about why that might be the case as we go along with the show, Ian. But essentially, it's the night of June 9th, the early morning of June 10th. And the small town of Villisca, Iowa, it's essentially, you know, small town USA. It's rural, rustic. Farming is its primary occupation. One night, somebody enters the house of a family known as the Moores. So you have Mr. Moore, Josiah, or J.B. Moore, who ran his own store selling goods to farmers and merchants and things like that. And his wife, Sarah, and their four children. And on this particular night, they had two guests staying over as well, two twin girls, Lena and Ina Stillinger, 8 and 11 years old. The deal was that they'd been at a church event this evening and had brought the girls home for a sleepover, which, you know, that means you've got six kids in the house, two of them sleeping downstairs, four of them sleeping upstairs, and then the adults sleeping in the master bedroom. And we don't know for sure whether the killer was hiding in the attic, in the house, concealed, or whether he was hiding in the barn. Because there is some evidence to suggest that he may have been casing the house, watching through a knot hole in the wood of the barn as people came and went. And this was kind of figured out because there was a depression in the hay that was laying right up against the wall of the barn, implying that someone had been on their belly, you know, leaving an imprint in the wall of the barn.
Okay. We say he, but do we know and I know that all of the suspects were male, and I read a little further up, but how did they eliminate the possibility that it could have been a woman?
Well, there are two reasons for that. I mean, number one is the fact that it takes tremendous strength to swing an axe with enough force, as much violence as was inflicted upon the victims of Villisca. The killer almost certainly killed the adults first, Mr. and Mrs. Moore, and the attack was absolutely savage. They were bludgeoned to death with an axe. The backswing left these gouges in the roof of the axe murder house that is still there to this day, if you look. You know, so it was intense savagery, and the hatchet that was used, the axe that was used, was the Moore's own axe. So the killer took the axe from their barn, it was believed. It was not used from the woodpile. It was an old axe, not particularly sharp, and swung this over and over again until the Moores were dead, then went and killed the four children upstairs, it's believed, and then went downstairs and killed the two visiting Stillinger girls afterwards. And, you know, I mean, yes, there are some strong females around, but the likelihood is that this was committed by a male.
Yeah, and I see your point on that. But, you know, it's always, I mean, I just make a small forensic point that you only need the strength to do that first swing, because after you break the integrity of the bone structure, I would think the subsequent swings wouldn't need the same force that the primary one did. But I only throw that out there because in a way I was surprised that it hadn't had a bigger connection to other sensational axe murderesses that had already become part of, you know, the public lexicon at that point. That's why I guess it surprised me that nobody. But anyway, so go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say what's interesting is that back in those days, there was a great theory that this was actually the work of a serial murderer. And back in those days, police forces didn't talk to one another.
No.
So you don't have this information network of cops, of detectives sharing information. And so small town Iowa, even when you have a sensation like this, there were a number of axe murders that took place throughout the Midwest. We had a couple of families killed very close to where I live, in fact, down in Colorado Springs. And the MO in all of those cases was incredibly similar. For example, the killer always picked a house without a dog, so there would be no barking to warn you that there was an intruder. The killer always used the family's own axe, never brought a weapon with them. The killer always closed the curtains and covered reflective surfaces inside the houses. The killer always posed and apparently molested the most attractive female in the house. The house was always within a very short distance of a railroad line. So a lot of these commonalities that were picked up only afterwards with careful analysis, and of course, hindsight's 20/20, isn't it, Ian?
Right. But, you know, and there's a couple of these cases along the railroad lines, which are very interesting. I also only make this minor point that was the role later on that true crime magazines filled. They were kind of the original national repository of these stories, and they were actively asking sheriff's departments and police departments to send in their stories, and that was some of the earliest known interdepartmental sharing was happening in the growth and the explosion of true crime magazines in the United States in the 1920s and into the 1930s. But so the parents are killed in the Villisca house, then their four children are killed. And then the two visiting, the twin girls that were downstairs that were there for a sleepover. And as far as anybody, there was no defensive wounds. There was no evidence of anybody running around. There was nobody seemingly who was aware that some other murder had happened to another room. That seemed unusual in and of itself, because that's a very quiet series of murders that are happening in a fairly compact space.
Yeah, that's a very salient point. And so there were suggestions that one of the victims, one of the Stillinger girls, may have attempted to either defend herself or flee. But the others were killed in their sleep. And as you pointed out earlier, one solid blow to the head will at the very least incapacitate most people. And then, of course, you're at your leisure. But how was noise not made in this case?
Right.
Fascinating.
Exactly.
That house is so small.
And how close are the nearest neighbors to the Villisca? Again, we're talking about the axe murderers of 1912 in Villisca, Iowa. How far away was the nearest neighbor?
So the neighbors that actually got suspicious were about 50 feet away. Their house is still there today. And a big shout out to a gentleman called Johnny Hauser, who was kind enough to write the foreword to my book. And Johnny is Mr. Villisca. He's been the caretaker of that house for at least 15 years. And knows pretty much everything there is to know about the case. And so Johnny lived in the house of the lady that first got suspicious. The following morning, the murders occurred, at least according to the physicians who certified the time of death, the murders occurred sometime close to midnight, to just after midnight, in the early morning hours of the 10th. And the family were early risers, you know, as most people that have livestock are. So when the neighbor came out, and realized that the Morehouse was strangely quiet, that their animals had not been tended to early that morning, and the Moors were usually early risers, she got disturbed, tried to open the doors of the house. They were locked. All of the curtains were still drawn. The shades were still drawn. So she ended up raising the alarm. And, of course, when authorities finally made entry to the house, they found that everybody inside was dead in bed.
And not just murdered, but then their faces were covered in what forensically is often described as a an act of concern about shame, that maybe the eyes of the victims were looking at the person. And we have, you make an assumption, or they were making an assumption, that then the murderer spent some time in the house before he fled.
Well, let's talk about why that's a reasonable assumption. Number one, some bacon was found, and I apologize if we offend anybody with this, but it was believed to have been used as a masturbatory aid.
Right, bacon.
Which would not have happened prior to the murders, almost certainly. The killer cleaned themselves up, and I'm just going to call the killer a him. So he cleaned himself up, scrubbed up, washed himself up nicely, made something to eat, and posed one of the victims, one of the Stillinger girls, very specifically. So, you know, all of that, of course, takes a certain amount of time to do. And in addition to covering the faces, it's very telling that he covered all reflective surfaces as well. Now, it makes sense that you close the curtains so that nobody passing by can see what you're doing. But the mirrors inside the house were also covered, as if the killer could not bear to look at his own image.
There were a variety of suspects. I mean, and not necessarily done with any kind of scientific analysis. There wasn't much yet available in that field anyway. But it wasn't a crime scene that benefited from the highest, you know, criminological minds in the United States looking at the evidence.
You're too kind. And first of all, let's cut them a little bit of slack. There are no great detectives in this part of the state. So you have a town marshal that deals with bar fights and has a drunk tank to run, you know, and suddenly finds himself dealing with front page news, national front page news. The big problem is that the people of Villisca, by the time police officers really got to the scene in any number and were able to control crowds, they'd all gone through the house. It was almost like a ghoulish show. You know,
exactly.
They'd seen for themselves what had been done to the Moore family and the Stillinger girls. And you had tens of people going through this house, all disturbing it, moving things. Some took souvenirs, for goodness sake. And so there was no way really to preserve the integrity of the scene for any great length of time.
And this aided the perpetrator. Because, I mean, not only would it have been hard to figure out who this was anyway, mm-hmm. but it just makes it narrowed that margin even further. And yet there was still a lot of finger pointing.
There was. And before we get to that, Ian, let's talk a little bit about the immediate aftermath. Okay. So, of course, everybody is outraged that this could happen in their town. So a mob starts to form, quite understandably, and they think, the killer can't have gotten far. The Moors were at church last night. Maybe he's still hiding here in town. And so they tear Villisca apart. They check every outhouse. They check every closet. They check every shed, you know. They check everything, that every possible hiding place, and don't find anybody. There is an encampment of homeless people on the outskirts of town, many of whom were African-American, and they had... Once they heard what had happened, they had the good sense to clear town before you know, someone could point the finger at them without any evidence.
Right.
And then bloodhounds are brought in on the train. So they bring in true professional bloodhounds. And the bloodhounds start out at the Moore house, and they lead this merry chase through the town, through the streets of Villisca, heading out of town. And finally, the trail goes cold out by the river. So... they never figure out, you know, the bloodhounds never quite figured out what happened.
Right.
The trail went cold. And at that point,
We'll have to hold it for a second, and then we'll come back. At this point, remember where you were, Richard, at this point. And we'll get back to that point coming up in just a minute. We're talking with Richard Estep, A Nightmare in Villisca, investigating the haunted axe murder house. Well, how does this scene of a horrible crime that was so sensational it knocked the investigation into the Titanic off the front pages, how does it become the most famous house for paranormal investigations? We'll get more into that. And what do they find? coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Here's where we were as we headed into the bottom of the hour. We were just learning a little bit more about what was happening at this point. Richard made a promise to remember where we were going at this point. And then we'll talk about then what has turned into one of the most famous houses for paranormal investigations. We'll get to that coming up in just a moment from Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Richard Estep is the author of this really terrific, fun book to read. As tragic as the story is, A Nightmare in Villisca, Investigating the Haunted Axe Murder House. So you were saying at this point, and we were talking about the post-murder investigation and all, where were you going with this?
So at this point, Ian, the trail's starting to go cold. They do have some suspects, and we'll name them in a minute. But it's important to understand that the people of Villisca, and this is in complete contrary opinion to pretty much everybody else that investigated the case, they believe that one of their own is responsible. They believe it may have been somebody from the town that was responsible. So they think that the killer may just be lurking in town. Maybe even he's a member of the mob that is joining them going through the street and is waiting to strike again. So for weeks afterwards, the town is like a cat on a hot tin roof. You have families that get together at night in the evening. They'll sleep two to a house, and then the men of the household will take turns standing watch all through the night, sitting there with a shotgun, just waiting for this killer to come back. And it's amazing, in fact, that we didn't see some fatal shooting accidents, you know, as people with itchy trigger fingers kind of started firing off rounds.
Right. It doesn't take much if you're a little edgy. You know, it could be just a branch falling off a tree and you get spooked out.
Or something like that coming by in the night.
Right.
And it really scarred this community, you know, and the town would never be the same after that.
You know,
but the suspects start to fall into line, and so they start to get grilled. One of the more prominent ones was a local politician. Now, the thing about this guy was that he was believed to have a feud with Mr. Moore. And there was a rumor circulating around the town that Josiah Moore had been making inappropriate phone calls to and possibly visits with his daughter-in-law, which would have provided a motive, you know? This is kind of interesting to me that one of the most prominent candidates was this big politician.
Sure.
I personally don't believe he was responsible, but, you know, you can never quite tell. They tried to pin it on a guy that had a record for axe murder, but turned out to have an alibi.
He had a record for axe murdering.
Yeah, if you can believe that. I mean, one of the guys they tried to pin it on ended up murdering his own mom afterwards, and yet he had a solid alibi. You know, axe murder was not as uncommon back then as we would think, incredibly.
Well, this led to the regulation of the axe industry, I believe, is what they started doing after that. They started, you had to register in advance. You could only, had a 3-day waiting period between when you could look at an axe and buy one. Did they ever consider a team? Did they ever consider that more than one person had done it, which would explain how they might have been able to get the murders done in the house at the same time in a compact space without anybody noticing?
They did. And in fact, the politician, Frank Jones, was kind of behind this team theory. He was the kind of guy that was rich enough and was well-known enough, you know, powerful enough, too, that he could hire somebody to take care of his dirty work for him. So there were a number of theories surrounding that, and it ended up ruining him, in fact, although he was never proven to be a particularly credible suspect, let alone found guilty. It destroyed his political aspirations and his business.
Sure.
But a candidate came forward that I think is probably the best fit for the Villisca axe murder of the conventional ones. I don't believe it was this guy. I believe in the idea that it was this serial killer, this hobo, that was riding the rails. But the best fit of the conventional candidates at the time was an Englishman, so apologies for that in advance. This was a priest called the Reverend George Kelly. Now, Kelly was kind of a twisted and fascinating character. We know that this guy was a pervert. And we know that because he was arrested for trying to lure underage girls by mail to take nude photographs for him, you know. And he was known to be a peeping Tom. And he'd been caught several times trying to look in the windows at females getting undressed. So he was known to be a peeping Tom as well, which kind of, you know, shows he has this sexually deviant aspect. And perhaps more damning, he's in the church with the Moore family on the night of the murders. He was present at that same church service. Now, the three things you know that you need, Ian, for a murder: means, motive, and opportunity, right?
Right.
So we have the motive. He's got this kind of background, this sexually deviant background. The means are pretty simple. He really just had to be in Villisca on the night and physically capable of carrying out the murders, which he was. And then opportunity. Well, he was staying with another priest in town, another reverend in town. But crucially, this other reverend had breathing problems, so he was sleeping in a tent in his yard that night, and Kelly had the house all to himself, which means had he so chosen, he could have slipped out late at night, gone and committed the murders, and nobody would have been any the wiser, because he was on a train out of Villisca the first thing the next morning, the first train out of town. He left.
By the way, so this is where that theory and your book overlaps with the famous Bill James book. Mm-hmm. You know the book I'm referring to, because we had him on as a guest, the famous baseball statistician and sports writer. And so he was doing a lot of it. He kind of came up with a pretty well-known, what he thought was a pretty reasonable suspect for who would have been the one that was committing all of these murders along the railroad. And are you on the same page with him on that?
I am. And I think that Bill Kelly is produced, and I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that his daughter was his writing partner and his research partner in that project. So the Jameses have done some amazing work. But just to close the book on Kelly real quick.
Right.
So this reverend confessed. He confessed to having killed them, that he was told to, by the voice of God, was led to the house, and he was told to slay and to slay utterly, his own words. So that should have been open and shut, right? Except a number of things don't quite add up, not least that he was a very puny specimen physically and may not have been physically capable of swinging the axe once or even twice. You know, this was a scrawny guy who was not very muscular and not in great shape. And also there's strong evidence that the police helped him to confess, if you know what I mean.
Sure,
that
sure.
Confession, was assisted with a few fists and feet, because there was a lot of pressure to close the book on this.
Right.
And, you know, there was a huge reward that was put up, was never claimed. And what happened to that reward money in the end, if you go to the cemetery in the town, which, if you should ever go to Villisca, I recommend going just to pay your respect. The Moore family, all six of them, are laid out in a row, side by side. There's a fairly, I don't want to call it opulent, it isn't, but it's certainly a very nice tombstone. That was bought and paid for by the unclaimed reward money. But the James's theory, the man from the train, makes a great deal of sense. And as you pointed out, he's a statistician. So he's good at seeing correlations and the links between things.
Right.
And he certainly has made a compelling case that you have this homeless psychopath, if you will, that is riding the rails from state to state across the Midwest, getting off the train when he feels like it. He would scope out a house near the train tracks, wait for the family to go to sleep at night, then break in and kill them. So I do subscribe to the James's theory, and I think that their book should be essential reading if you want to understand the Villisca Axe murders.
Yeah, very interesting. Pull on one thread that I remember, it either came out that night or came in when I was finishing reading the book after I'd done the show. Do you know where the that American neologism comes from, hobo?
I don't, actually.
So I think it's one of those words which could have a couple of different, you know, etymologies, but I think the one that strikes me in light of this conversation was it stood for a ho boy. So it would be a corruption of ho boy, which meant farmhand. somebody who was just doing the heavy kind of work around a farm, you know, hoeing and axing and doing all of that sort of stuff, which is why that kind of overlaps. You know, somebody once said too, it was shortened from homeward bound, but I've never been able to find any proof of that. But I think that idea of them swinging a hoe would certainly be consistent with somebody who would go do this migrant farm work, get back on the train, and then go on to another farm community. And nobody ever bothered to find out what their names were, or they could have used any name they wanted. There was no cataloging them. There was no reason to take federal income tax or, you know, FICA or anything from them. So they would have just, you know, they could have called themselves anything and got on and off the train at will, as they very likely did for decades.
And you can see why law enforcement would not join the dots. That no, there was no overall law enforcement agency that was looking at these very common crimes that were springing up. You know, nobody put all these pieces together at the time.
Right. So the murder is that of legend, and there are lots of different people who continue to tell the story, and it's just, as you sort of commented, a couple of really good books investigating it. But that's not where your book takes us. Your book takes us to a very present tense experience, which is the ongoing investigation of the haunted axe murder house. So fill in a couple of decades in there. What happens to the house after the horrible tragedy of the murder of the eight people that were inside?
Absolutely. And you're right. You know, my book only contains really a chapter on the history. It's an overview.
Right.
For those that want the full story, I recommend Murdered in Their Beds by Troy Taylor and The Lisker by Roy Marshall, two authorities on the case. And of course, Bill James's book, The Man from the Train. But
yeah,
my focus really is as a paranormal researcher. So I'm interested in haunting locations. And of course, the history is a key part of that. So you always have to start there. But what's fascinating is that the house is a private residence throughout the rest of its life. So a number of owners come and go. It's rented out to various tenants. And yeah, there's some stigma. It's always going to be that house, you know, especially in the town of Villisca. It's always going to be infamous. But one of the things about the haunting is that there aren't any truly reliable or many truly reliable accounts of it being haunted until, I would say, the 1990s. Now, a couple of exceptions. There were some children that lived in the house, were raised in the house, that reported being grabbed. They would sleep in the parlor of the house back then when they were growing up. They would report being grabbed, and one of them claimed that her father was cleaning a knife one day in the kitchen when some invisible force basically grabbed his hand and made him stab himself.
Ah. That,
you know,
that was unusual in one sense, because a lot of communities had, when they had a scar like that, they would rid themselves of that. And so they would light it on fire, or they would plow it under, or somebody would come along and they would build a park there or something. But this didn't. This house continued to be used as a home. How much long after the murders before somebody else moved in, do you know?
I can't give you an exact figure on that, I'm afraid. I don't know.
No.
But the house was pretty consistently occupied. And what's interesting is seances took place there. We do know that. A number of people decided to give that a try. We don't know what the results were. And then it fell into a state of disrepair in the 1990s, and you were actually, there was a strong chance that the house was just going to become dilapidated and have to be demolished, which is almost what happened, until a local man by the name of Darwin Lynn, along with his wife Martha, bought it with the intent of trying to restore it to some semblance of its former state.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they did. The house was in a pretty shocking state of disrepair at that point. It had been abandoned for a little bit, not lived in. And Darwin and his friends, family, associates worked extremely hard to restore the house. And what's interesting is that the majority of the ghost stories begin, the vast majority begin, after that restoration process.
Right. I got a text tonight from a friend of mine, Wendy, who wrote this to me just as we started our conversation. Oy vey, she said, my father is from Villisca. He's been best friends with the current owner of the Villisca Axe Murder House since first grade. That's 75 years of being friends. And he agrees 100% with the analysis in this book. So that's very interesting too.
That's a huge compliment. Please thank them for me.
Yeah. So I'm glad to have a little bit more of the history. And now we get to that weird part where is it just a matter that the whole haunted house industry starts to kick in and television products are made and there's money in it that more people report something, which then they can on the back end that they can monetize and turn it into a B&B or do something with it? I mean, are you a little bit suspicious about the chronology of that?
I'm always suspicious when money changes hands. I mean, by profession, I'm actually a paramedic. So I work with a lot of cops, and I get to pick their brains on certain things. And I talked with a couple of detectives about their opinions on the Valesky case. But one general principle that I've never forgotten, a detective taught me, he said, Richard, you've always got to ask yourself one question, right? Who benefits? In other words,
Yeah.
does somebody benefit from a place being haunted or from a place being a certain way? So I definitely would consider that as a possibility. But talking to anybody in Villisca, the Lynns are very reputable people. You
Right.
know, they did not get into this to make a buck. They got into this to restore this iconic location and prevent it from being torn down.
Right.
And they certainly put so much money into it. It was not a cheap thing to do. So I'm not a big believer in this particular case, that it was done for the money. I don't find that to be
No.
likely.
I was just kind of throwing that out there.
No, it's a very valid point.
It's just hard sometimes for me to separate. And I know that you have an affiliation with some of these ghost shows, but as I mentioned with our previous guest, it's always a little difficult to swallow that as soon as the cameras, turn on and the everything goes infrared, that suddenly the ghosts are running around the house like sugared up kids at a birthday party. And that part, I'm always a little suspicious that they appear on cue. But I will say something which I had teased earlier, and I meant to mention it. So you are currently a paramedic and an educator, paramedic educator. And our first guest tonight, Randy Liebig, is a former police officer. And I always think that's kind of those, that's always an interesting connection. That's something I hear and see a lot. So I'm going to ask you the question I asked him, the standard cop question. I'll just ask you, as a paramedic, and then we'll hold for your answer. As a paramedic, what evidence have you ever seen on the job of something which people would categorize as paranormal? We'll get to that answer coming up. And then we'll get back to the story of the various investigations into the Axe Murder House next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.